Have you tested? Okay, this time we begin the tech test. My name is Dick. Thank you, Romeo, India, with me.
Number one on the runway this week.
So Joe doesn't even have to sign in. We're going to take him right away. Anyone else? We know. I know we've got Paul WS2N and John KC2WGB. Anyone else who wants to sign in because they do have a question or comment, please give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW.
And WS2N, yeah, I just want to let you know I am here, Dick, for a space report.
Glad to hear that, Paul. One last call. Anyone to check into the TechNet at this time? Please give me your call letters and name. Okay, let's start off with Joe. He'd requested it be number one on the runway today because he chimed in last week and we didn't have time to get to him. WA2, Romeo, Yankee, Yankee. Go right ahead, Joe. K2RIW in the tech man.
Okay, good evening, Dick. The question I have left over from last week is this. It has to do with putting ferrite beads around a piece of coax cable to help act as a choke. I come by a website that sells these things, and I want to know a little bit more about it before I go buy these things. They fit around RG-213, RG-8, LMR-400, N9913. Now, they have a rating of, let's see here, 25 ohms at 1 meg, they say, 71 ohms at 5 meg, 100 ohms at 10 meg, 156 ohms at 25 meg, 260 ohms at 100 meg. So that's part of the question. What I want to know really if you're using more of these. I can provide. I want to use I guess a few of these, and that's why I want to know if I'm going right in the right direction. The other part of the question is they say that this one particular clamp on assembly is used type 31 mix. That's part of the question I don't understand. So do you know much about these wrap-on, wrap-around ferrite assemblies that go around coax cable, Dick? Back to you.
I'm a little bit late on ferrite bead knowledge. I'll tell you what I know, what I don't know, and hopefully one of the people who is quite familiar with the subject, Glenn, KC2QIQ, will also chime in after I give my little piece. To many people, it's a little bit mysterious how I can take an extremely small ferrite bead, in some cases, put it over the lead of, let's say, a resistor, and now I've created more inductance. How in the world can that happen? And whether the thing going down the center of the ferrite bead is a single wire or a whole coax cable, in either case, it does a little bit of magic. And let me show you what's going on. There is something called the right-hand rule that's often used and it's taught to electrical engineering students, that if I'm holding my right hand around a piece of wire, and if the current is flowing in the wire in the direction of my thumb, my fingers wrapping around the wire show you the direction that the magnetic field lines are flowing around that wire. So the magnetic field lines want to flow as circles around that wire. It's one of the results of so-called Faraday's law of current flowing. The rate of change of current creates a voltage drop as a function of inductance. Okay, so the magnetic field created by the current flow from the right-hand rule wants to flow around the wire like the fingers wrapped around the wire. You put a material of any kind where magnetic field will flow in it, and if the material you place there has a mu is that permeability. In other words, if your material will allow magnetic field to flow through it better than through air, and there are materials out there that have a permeability as high as 100, maybe even as high as 1,000. In other words, it's possible to have a material where the magnetic field flows through the material 1,000 times better than it flows through air, and it wants to flow in these circles around the wire, and you put a toroidal piece of material that's exactly like those lines of force around that wire. So by doing that simple act of putting that ferrite bead around that wire, you drastically increase the inductance. An ordinary straight piece of wire has a rough rule of thumb of 22 nanohenries per inch. Each inch of wire with the usual layout above a chassis
That's 22 nanohenries for each individual inch. You put a mu material of 1,000, a permeability of 1,000 material over that piece of wire, and the 22 nanohenries can be 22 microhenries.
Repeater, timeout.
Nanohenries versus microhenries is a 1,000-to-1 ratio. So 22 nanohenries can be become 22 microhenries. And in most cases, you're allowed to put multiple ones of these beads. In other words, each one of those beads is making that much of an improvement. And if you stack multiple beads, you get more and more of that improvement. Now, in the particular material that's being advertised that Joe is talking about, let me drop, which had 1 megahertz, creates 25 ohms of inductive reactance. And at 1 megahertz and 25 ohms, the usual rule is that the inductance equals 2 pi FL. 2 pi is a constant, really 6.28. The frequency in hertz, inductance in Henry, and you plug those two together, and you know the amount of inductive reactance. So you can plug in the 25 ohms and find out how many millihenry or microhenry that is. And if at 1 megahertz you get 25 ohms of inductive reactance, and now you put two of those beads on there, you're going to get at least twice. The 25 ohms could become 50 ohms. That's if these are two thoroughly independent ferrite beads, and if they're closely stacked to each other, sometimes you get an extra benefit, very similar to what happens with putting turns on a solenoid coil to make inductance. Let me drop.
Sounds like digital mobile radio on the input.
If all of the magnetic field happens to link all of the turns of your solenoid coil, because you wound the coil in a very desirable mechanical layout, large diameter of the coil, very close spacing of the turns, if all of the magnetic field links all of the turns, then the amount of inductance goes up as the number of turns squared, not linear. Well, by stacking together ferrite beads, you can get some of that additional effect. Now, when it comes to the material of your toroid that you're putting onto your coax cable to act as a choke, and by the way, if you did take upon your balloning device that you can buy, Uniteller is one of the brand names among very many others, if you took it apart and you looked inside, in many cases what you're going to see is a straight piece of RG8 coax cable with a bunch of these toroidal magnetic field things, whether it's powdered iron, whether it's ferrite, no matter what the material is, you're going to see a number of them stacked in there. And now, if I was operating at 1 megahertz, that happens not to be a ham band, but if I was operating at 1 megahertz and I wanted some real good choking action, 25 ohms of inductive reactance by using one of these devices, that's a step in the right direction, not quite enough. You'd like the inductive reactance of the outside of your coax cable to be considerably higher than the impedance of your cable. If you're using 50 ohm cable, it would sure be nice to get 500 ohms of inductive reactance. Well, at 25 ohms per coil, per device, that would sound like you're going to stack an awful lot of them. Part of what's going on here, let me drop, is that by this means, at a frequency as low as 1 megahertz, it's kind of difficult to get a significant amount of inductive reactance. And so you might get more for your money, so to speak, by doing the poor man's balance of multiple turns of coax cable held together with black tape near the antenna. What's going on here is that a balanced antenna, like a dipole, fed in the center, even though you would like the center conductor to feed the right-hand side of the dipole and the shield of the coax cable to feed the left-hand side, and you think that that's going to be a good feeding mechanism, it's a beginning. It's not perfect. The dipole itself wants to force balance. If you're putting 100 volts on your dipole, it really wants to rebalance that to be 50 volts on the right side, 50 volts on the left side. Well, in that example I'm giving of 100 volts between the center conductor and the shield of your cable, and it rearranges itself when it hits the dipole, the 50 volts that's on the left-hand side, maybe it's really going to be 45, but something in that direction, all of that voltage now, for the first time, starts flowing back down the outside of your coax cable. And so now your transmission line, your coax cable, becomes part of the antenna because it is RF hot. And now, for the first time, the length of the transmission line does affect the resonant frequency of the dipole, because by way of that coupling mechanism, you're feeding RF energy onto it, affecting its resonant frequency. Under normal circumstances, if you've got the right kind of a balancing device, let me drop. You've got the right kind of a balancing device mounted near your coax, near the antenna, so that now the antenna is being fed in a thoroughly balanced manner, and by way of the choking action of your balancing device, essentially no RF current can flow down the outside of the cable. And assuming your cable is relatively low in loss, particularly if it was open wire line, then in that particular case that I'm now describing, the length of the transmission line does not change standing wave ratio. Say those words on a Saturday afternoon at 20 meters, and a hell of a lot of people are going to give you a lot of flack, because they have been led to believe that for an antenna to be in full performance, it must be fed with a transmission line that is some equal number of half wavelengths or some equal number of full wavelengths of the frequency of operation. And there are lots and lots of people, including the people who write the columns for QST magazine, who used to believe that your third watt meter trying to read forward power and reverse power only reads correctly if there's a magic length of transmission line between the bird watt meter and the antenna. There are lots and lots of people who believe this because they see these changes happening when they change the length of line, and they didn't realize that those changes that they're seeing are because of the lack of a good balancing device at the antenna, which is making a change, but it's not what you think is going on. Let me drop. But under normal circumstances, the changing the length of the line does not truly change what's really going on at the antenna. The antenna is not a pure 50 ohm resistive load, in the case of using 50 ohm cable, and some amount of the power you feed into the antenna is going to be reflected. That's just the way transmission lines work. It's got a so-called characteristic impedance, which is either 50 ohms or 70 ohms, depending on which brand of cable and what model number you're using. But if you don't use a resistor as a load of that exact number, then a calculatable amount of power you send to the antenna is going to be reflected, and that reflected power will come all the way back down that cable, regardless of how long the cable is. The only slight change that really happens when everything's fed correctly is that real transmission line has a little bit of loss to it, and as you make the line longer and longer, the signal going forward gets a little bit weaker, and the amount that's reflected also gets a little bit weaker on the back down. So the apparent standing wave ratio you measure in the shack is going to be a little bit lower than it really is at the antenna. But even that is calculatable. But under normal circumstances, there is no magic length of transmission line to make the antenna work well. Lots and lots of people believe that. Now, when it comes to the advantages of ferrite, powdered iron, and whatever, I know that Glenn has got lots of opinions on that subject. I hope Glenn is available now, and if not, maybe Glenn will be joining us a little bit later, and we're going to come back to this particular subject, because there's a lot more information here that I don't know. KC2QIQ, if you're available, Glenn. K2RIW on the TechNet. Quite often Glenn joins us a little bit later, and so when he does, we're going to pick his brain on this. When it comes to people within the sound of my voice who do or don't have experience with various mixes of powdered iron, ferrite material, and whatever the materials that toroids are made out of that are used for being put over coax cable in order to increase their choking action on the outside conductor, or there are kinds of choking devices where you can, they've got enough internal area to their center circle so you can put multiple turns of either your wire or your coax cable through it. People who have experience with these materials, please give me your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Thanks very much, Mike.
Okay, we heard nothing but X-ray mic. At the very beginning, I think all got missed. So please give us your full call letter, sir, and your name, and then proceed with your information. Blank, blank, X-ray mic, KQRIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick. You've got it, sir.
Dick of the TechNet, this is Rich, WD2 Golf X-ray mic. The different mixes are good for different frequencies. Mix 31, I believe, is good between 3 and 30 megahertz. Another mix which is 43, another mix which is 61. And I know other people have more detailed information on the frequency bands that these mixes are effective for. Also, in the current issue of Nuts and Volts magazine, they have an article on ferrites, WB2GXM.
Thank you, Rich. That's good information. What I think is going on here is a little bit similar to what happens when you're building a 60-cycle transformer versus a 400-cycle transformer versus a transformer that's being used for high-frequency switching power supplies. In the case of a 60-cycle transformer, you have individual EI laminations of that core, and those EI laminations have a certain thickness to them. If you made the core out of a solid chunk of iron at extremely low frequency, the magnetic field would flow through there very nicely. However, if you take a cross-section of that iron, it really acts like a shorted turn, as if there was a turn on the transformer itself. By making the core out of thin sheets of material with EI lamination, you break up those eddy currents that I'm now discovering. And so, as you go to higher and higher frequencies, you've got to use thinner and thinner laminations in order to get high efficiency out of that kind of a core for a 60-cycle, 400-cycle, or 10 kilohertz transformer, so to speak. There's an ideal thickness of each of the individual sheets of material. When it comes to these toroidal-shaped devices, the powdered iron, the ferrite, or whatever material, the individual particles that are in that mix held together with some kind of a binder. Let me drop. Those individual particles have a certain size to them. And as you want to go to higher and higher frequencies, the individual particles have to be smaller and smaller so that you're not developing any currents within the individual particles, which is a loss mechanism. So you've got a bit of a trade-off here. As you make the particles smaller and smaller, your toroid can go to higher and higher frequencies. That's the good news. However, the laws of physics dictate that as you make the particles smaller and smaller, and you put them in this binding material, epoxy or whatever, you're now getting a higher and higher percentage of epoxy to iron particles as you make the particles smaller and smaller. So you get less and less permeability. So the trade-off is how fine are the particles tells you how high a frequency you can go to, but most likely the higher frequency material, you need more of it to get the same amount of magnetic field of conduction, the permeability. So that's why there's an ideal frequency region for each of these materials, depending on how they're made. There's got to be more information out there. Give me your call letters if you've got anything on the subject of toroids, ferrites, powdered iron, and so on. If you've got some experience of what worked, what didn't work, and you know about particular brand names, please give us the wisdom of your experience right now. Your call letters and name, KQRIW listening. Listening. right now, Joe, but as Glenn signs in later on, we're going to come back to the subject. To be 2LYY, I wonder if any of this is helping at all, Joe. To be 2LYY, K2IW in the TechNet.
Of course it helps. It definitely helps. It also, makes it easy to understand what you're going to talk a little bit about and so forth. Like the Type 31 mix, I didn't know what that meant, but the gentleman came in and said to go up to 33 to 30 megahertz, which is exactly where I plan to use this thing on a couple HF antennas, so that's helpful information. So, I can't learn everything in one sitting, but, I'll be patient and I'll listen for a while, and maybe Glenn will check in a little later on. In reality, when you start stacking more of these ferrite assemblies over the coax cable to increase the inductance or reactance that they apparently have at a particular frequency, what does that tend to do to the standing wave ratio? Did you say go to a ratio of 10 times the inductance compared to the impedance of the coax cable? What does that tend to do?
That's a darn good question, Joe, and I think I know what you're asking. The magic of a coax cable is that as the signal is being launched into that cable from the transmitter, all of that signal is contained in between the center conductor and the inner surface of the outer conductor. Your valuable RF energy is completely inside of that cable when it's launched into that cable from the transmitter. And whether the outside of the cable in a great big structure where it's got multiple turns, whether it goes straight, whether it's got sharp turns, whether the cable is laying near metallic objects or whatever, all of that doesn't matter. The RF energy flowing down that cable has no idea what's going on in the outside world. Okay? However, if at the antenna itself, the balanced characteristic of the antenna starts relaunching some of that signal back down the outside of the coax cable, now the length of the cable does make a difference. It's becoming part of the resonant length of your antenna, if you know what I mean. So making the cable longer and shorter is going to be raising and lowering cyclically the center frequency of your antenna because of this coupling characteristic if there isn't a balancing device there. And I was just using a very rough rule of thumb that's true of very many engineering circumstances. If I'm putting in a resistor because I want to create some stability of an oscillating amplifying transistor, in many cases, the 10-to-1 rule is very handy. I'll give you another example of that. In the case of a dipole being fed in a thoroughly symmetric manner, at one instant of time, the right-hand side of the dipole and the left-hand side is negative during the first half cycle. During the second half cycle of the RF, those voltages are reversed. The right side is going to be negative, and the left side is going to be positive.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
The main point I'm making is that the antenna itself is a thoroughly symmetric device where there is a neutral plane right at the center of the dipole. You could put an infinite sheet of metal at right angles to the wire of your dipole, right down the center. You would not be changing the impedance of the antenna, the gain of the antenna, the pattern of the antenna. You're putting a conducting device right at the neutral plane between the right side and the left side of the dipole. Once you realize that symmetry exists, you can then decide to feed the right side of the dipole compared to that infinite sheet of metal and throw away the left-hand side of the dipole. And you take the whole structure and rotate it 90 degrees, and we now call that a vertical ground plane antenna, quarter wave ground plane antenna. So you want that sheet of metal in the ideal world to go to infinity. In reality, you're going to put some ground plane radials down, which is the poor man's equivalent of an infinite sheet of metal. And as long as you lay down enough of those individual quarter wavelength long ground plane radials, you're doing a pretty good job of recreating that infinite sheet of metal. However, in order for everything to be really efficient when you've got this thing near the ground, you would like the impedance of the counterpoise, that sheet of metal, the pseudo sheet of metal, your individual ground plane radials, you would like that impedance to be very small compared to the antenna. Let me show you how that gives you a problem. The thoroughly symmetric dipole fit in the center is something like a 72 ohm impedance. We need only half of the dipole compared to the sheet of metal. You've got something like 36 ohms of impedance. Now you set this up as a vertical ground plane antenna, and you want it to be efficient. Therefore, you would like the impedance to the rest of the world, the impedance to the universe of your counterpoise, your individual ground plane radios. You'd like that to be 1/10 of 36 ohms. You'd like that to be 3.6 ohm impedance. If you did that, you would have 3.6 ohms of impedance of your so-called infinite sheet of metal, but you've got 36 ohms of impedance of the real quarter wave ground plane radiator. And as you can see, 90% of the energy is going to go into the right place, only 10% of it goes into the wrong place, and therefore you're going to have at least a 90% efficient antenna. You lay down too few ground plane radials so that the impedance of that counterpoise is, let me pick the number, 36 ohms, and the antenna is 36 ohms. You might have to do some re-impedance matching, but half your power is going into that counterpoise, and now the signals that are on the ground plane radials that are essentially in contact with the ground, Earth, and Earth is a resistive volumetric material. You launch RF energy into Earth, you'll be heating up the Earth, you'll be keeping the worms a little bit warm in the wintertime, they'll be happy, but the efficiency of your antenna goes down. That gives you a little bit of a feeling for what's going on when people, let me drop. Some people who are very serious will recommend you lay down 32 individual ground plane radials. You're trying to really simulate that infinite sheet of metal, and you'd like there to be less and less RF energy going into that counterpoise, because the RF energy that goes into the counterpoise, that's not when it's not acting like a perfect short circuit, so to speak, because there's not enough ground plane radials or not enough big enough equivalent sheet of metal, the RF energy that goes into it can become wasted. Now, that problem goes away when you discuss something like a station master antenna. That station master antenna on your repeater is up at the top of your tower. It's many wavelengths above the Earth, and you'll notice that it doesn't have 32 ground plane radials. It's got three little stubby things coming off at a 45-degree angle. Your first question is going to be, how come three radials in that case work like a charm, whereas down at Earth itself, my 40-meter ground plane radial, my 40-meter ground plane vertical antenna, I should lay down a whole bunch of ground plane radials. How come I need 32 to have high efficiency when it's against the ground, but only three when it's up in the air? And the reason for that is, yes, those three up in the air in that station master, lots of RF energy is on the tips of those ground plane radials, but still, they are so far away from Earth, they're not coupling energy to the Earth, and you're not getting the waste. And they're doing the main thing they're supposed to do of stopping a good deal of the RF energy from flowing down the outside of the coax cable. So there's the paradox. People can't quite understand why a station master has only three radials, and you could put 33 radials on there if you wanted to, and you'd get essentially no improvement. Let me drop. And yet when your ground plane vertical antenna is in contact with Earth, laying down as many radios as you can, as your pocketbook will let you do, you get a continuous increase in performance. There have been a number of articles in which people have experimented, W2FMI, among other people, have experimented with putting down very few ground plane radios by a very difficult process measuring the efficiency of their antenna and laying down more and more radios and look at the rate of change of efficiency. And somewhere around 32 radials, you're getting a law of diminishing returns. In other words, as you start laying down 64 radials instead of 32, you're only getting a small percentage of improvement, and it's almost not worth it. You're better off buying a 120-watt transmitter instead of a 100-watt transmitter rather than laying down 32 more radials. Does it give you a little bit of a feeling for what's going on here, Joe? W2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
DPC with a comment.
Okay, go right ahead there. Hal, let's see, I wonder, in the case of the vertical ground plane radios that you have installed, I wonder what's your magic number for the number of ground plane radios, and let me give you one other fact here, and that is, if you're feeding a radiator from the bottom, quarter wave ground plane vertical antenna, and if you've decided to make it electronically a half wave long, the good news is now the point that you're feeding for that radiator, instead of it being a 35 ohm impedance, it could easily be a 1500 ohm impedance. And in that particular case, because your radiator is half wave long, you don't need a whole bunch of ground plane radials. A simple grounding rod in the earth could be almost enough. K6DPZ, K2RIW, tell us your experience along these lines, Hal.
RIW and the TechNet K6DPZ. Okay, we're going to tell you a little story. I have a main high tower I installed in my property, and I am sitting basically on the water. Water is three spaces around me. Well, put that high tower in, put six copper rods, and at 12 feet, I'm in salt water. And I don't use any radials, and the thing has a perfect match. And it's a quarter wave type antenna. I think that you're familiar with the high power, high gain, high power antenna. It's K2RIW, K6DPZ.
In your particular case, you didn't lay down a whole bunch of radials, and you said you got a good impedance match. That scares me a little bit because the fact that I get a good impedance match, the fact that I get a low standing wave ratio, simply tells me that of all of the hardware hanging at the far end of that transmission line, if all of that hardware acts like a 50 ohm resistor, because you match to your transmission line. However, that 50 ohm load out there, it might be 25 ohms of lossy earth and 25 ohms of antenna, if you know what I mean. And in the case of having salt water nearby, the amount of hardware you've got to lay down to make a good, efficient antenna, it's very much simpler. But measuring antenna efficiency to try to figure out how much of your valuable RF energy is going into heating the soil of your backyard, that's a very difficult measurement to make. And so the standing wave ratio you measured, saying you've got a good match, that's unnecessary but not sufficient. It tells you that the signal is slowing down the transmission line once and not coming back. It doesn't necessarily tell you where it's going. What percentage of that is radiated to space, and what percentage of that is coupled into the earth that's above your salt water, is an interesting question. Over to you, Hal. K6DPZ, K2RIW, the TechNet.
RIW and TechNet, K6DPZ. Rick, I have a GR1650 impedance bridge. We measured the impedance right at the antenna feed point, not through the coax. And we got about 52.5 ohms impedance. So we got a match, and the salt water with three copper rods going into the salt water makes a very good counterpoise. I just didn't take a standing wave meter and measure at the other end. I measured the base impedance of the antenna. I used to be a broadcast engineer, and we used to do antenna pattern work. I have all the gear, Dick.
Okay. Once again, Hal, I think there is a necessary but not sufficient here. A broadcast engineer could have an inadequate ground plane radial system. He does his impedance matching right at the feed point of the antenna, right out in the backyard, so to speak, and he measures 52 ohms, we'll say. That alone, that measurement doesn't tell him what percentage of that impedance is the vertical radiator and what percentage of that impedance is the earth characteristic. In other words, he could still be coupling energy into the earth. A good impedance match is great. It still doesn't tell you where the RF energy is going. It doesn't tell you whether or not you've got enough ground plane radials so that you're not coupling that RF energy into the local soil. You see what I'm saying on this one, Hal? K6DPZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
RIW in the TechNet, K6DPZ. I ran a test with a dipole in three space of 20 meters. And I ran a test with a high tower with a field intensity measurement. Both readings were very close, Dick. So the amount of RF radiation was pretty good, diced against a dipole in three space. Got it on. I just wanted to throw it in for what it was worth. And your conversation is very interesting on the TechNet. But I ran the test. I know what you're saying about efficiency and effective radiated power and so on. Amazingly, this thing is working very well.
I'm glad to hear that. There's still another problem. If I'm comparing it in field strength to a dipole, say a horizontally polarized dipole at some altitude in the air, and I'm making a measurement, let's say, a mile away, and I'm measuring volts per meter, versus my vertical ground plane radial system, I'm now comparing a horizontally polarized signal to a vertically polarized signal. They reflect off the ground different ways, and therefore the field strength that I measure a mile away in microvolts per meter, it's not easy to interpret that one now. Without a doubt, if you've got a similar reading, it's an extremely good piece of evidence that probably most of your RF energy is being radiated to space. But it's not completely clear, because there's a little bit of an apple orange here between the horizontal dipole and the ground plane. And if your dipole for the test was a vertically polarized dipole, it's still at a different altitude. Its phase center is a different altitude than the real vertical ground plane radial system. So, again, it's a slightly difficult comparison. You see what I'm worried about here, Hal? K6DPZ, K2LIW in the deck net.
We worked with a vertical dipole, Dick. So we're on the same vertical plane for both. You know, I'm not going to use a horizontal dipole to make a field density measurement on a vertical antenna. And the wave density dipole wasn't that large. I ran a calibration on it, and we were able to, you know, get the readings. It has to be on the same polarity, not one vertical, one horizontal. And I was very surprised how well the high tower was doing, you know, with just a radio system using the salt water and six copper rods driven into the salt water at the base of the antenna. There you go. K6DPZ is going to be clear.
Yeah, in Oceanside, you've got a great advantage of having salt water so close to you that your local earth, so to speak, is a highly conductive material. Salt water, by the way, has a characteristic resistivity of 0.2 ohm meter. That means if you measured its characteristic resistivity by starting off with a plastic box that is 1 meter cube, and you make two sides of the box, the left side and the right side, a sheet of metal, one square meter, and now you put your ohm meter, an AC ohm meter between the two, with salt water in there, seawater, you'll measure 0.2 ohm, highly conductive material. And the good news is when it comes to working with antennas, to work over salt water, you've got a huge advantage. The disadvantage of salt water is that if you're waiting in that salt water in your basement to, because Superstorm Sandy has come along, let me drop it. And you're recovering the valuables in your basement as that salt water comes pouring in, and the electrical power is turned on. And if anything in the electrical system in your house is touching that salt water, and you're wading through it, oh boy, you're in a lot of trouble. I don't care how valuable your stuff is, do not go there when the power is turned on. Do not wade through the salt water of your basement. Of the 60 or whatever it is people who supposedly drowned during Superstorm Sandy, you guys have heard me say in the past, I think a significant percentage of those people didn't drown from drowning, they drowned from electrocution, is my guess, from some of the descriptions I've heard. I know we're getting off subject here, but still, I think it's good information we should all have. Do you have access to the materials you're talking about, Joe, this number 31, number 43, and number 61 materials? And so, by reading those data sheets, finding out what diameters they've got, and how many of them you want to stack onto your piece of coax cable, and if you take apart a Unadilla, let me drop it.
Dick. Dick, just to make it quick here, I sent you an email link to the place that sells this stuff. Did you read that one yet?
No, I have not. Haven't been near my computer for quite a few days. John, KC2WGB, you're better here with your comment. And how are things doing with EchoLink website that you're monitoring? You got it, John.
K2WGB. Well, it's all quiet. Got a few on EchoLink. Chat room's quiet. Just wanted to make a suggestion. After you complete this discussion with Joe, you may want to cover a few of the correct ways to collect that empirical data, because we do get a lot of antenna questions, and I think that's a perfect topic to cover at this time. It seems that we have a few minutes, so maybe you could give a little speech on that. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
The main point that I was making earlier is that to measure overall antenna efficiency, to try to calculate, to try to measure what percentage of your RF energy is being coupled into the local soil, the resistive volumetric material in your backyard, to find out what percentage of your RF energy is coupled into that soil versus coupled into free space and really radiated. That measurement is not easy. Hal was telling us that he set up a vertical dipole as the standard antenna, and he put some amount of signal into the dipole, some amount of signal into the ground plane, vertical ground plane antenna, and then at some distance away, maybe a mile, maybe 10 miles, measure field strength that each one of those antennas can create. That's a good beginning measurement, but there's a problem. Even if your test antenna, a full symmetric half-wave dipole versus your ground plane, by definition, the phase center of your ground plane antenna, that phase center is very close to Earth. The vertical dipole, in order for it to be high enough above the ground that the lower half of the dipole is not touching the ground, you now have a phase center higher up above ground, probably a quarter wave higher than your vertical ground plane antenna system. So it makes the comparison a little bit different. As you change the altitude of the phase center of the antenna that's doing the transmitting, the way the signal reflects off the ionosphere, the way it reflects off the ground, and the way it gets to your 1 mile away test site is slightly different. And so comparing the results is not quite as direct as it sounds. If this is the best of all worlds, let me drop.
Quick comment. Isn't that very similar to the discussion we had a few weeks ago about checking HTs, different antennas, some are the half wave, some are the quarter wave? Isn't that the same problem we were discussing, basically?
It sure is. We'd like to all think that because we've set up a transmitter on this mountain, and you've got a receiving site on the other mountain, you would like to think that we've got pure line of sight, that 99% of the RF energy out of the first transmitting antenna on the first mountain goes straight over to the second antenna on the second mountain. You'd like to believe that's the dominant path. Not true at all. The good news about RF energy is once you transmit RF energy into space, it goes into every single cubic centimeter of this universe. And I'm not kidding. It goes everywhere. The good news, it goes everywhere. And so somebody can be hidden in the bottom of a hole a mile away, and although the signal he's going to get is very weak, if he's got sensitive enough equipment, he's got that RF energy. It goes everywhere. That's the good news. The bad news, because it goes everywhere, you've always got multipath. That signal you're transmitting, a calculatable amount of it is reflecting off the gutters and the downspouts of your house, the tower that's across the street, the water tower, the building down the street, and whatever. It's bouncing off every possible object that was in, I was about to say within line of sight. Doesn't even have to be within line of sight. Some of the hardware that is behind a hill that is not within line of sight of your antenna, some of that signal is being coupled over that hill by knife edge diffraction, and it's still hitting that water tower that's behind the hill, if you know what I mean. And all of those signals reflecting off all of those objects, and the objects that are doing the reflecting do not have to be metallic. You're getting a calculatable amount of reflection off of the leaves of the trees in your backyard. I'll admit at 80 meters, those leaves are very, very close to transparent. You get up to 432, and those leaves now become an extremely anechoic material right after a rain. In other words, the RF energy hitting those wet leaves, almost all of it gets coupled into the water, just like in your microwave oven, so to speak, gets turned into heat, and the RF energy is lost. So to measure efficiency, to measure what's called TRP, total radiated power, in the case of a handy talkie or a cell phone-like device, the accepted procedure today, let me drop. The accepted procedure today is called the TRP test. The TRP test is usually done with a SATAMO device. What is a SATAMO device? It is a ring of individual dipole-like sensing devices, 32 or 64 of them in this ring. This ring is mounted in an anechoic chamber. You put your device under test in the middle of that ring, and you slowly rotate the device under test 360 degrees while all of those individual 32 or 64 dipoles on that ring are collecting the energy. You're literally plotting the full 4 pi steradian, full three-dimensional space antenna pattern, and you're quantitatively measuring the total amount of energy that's going out of your, let's say, cell phone that you're testing in all directions in space. You add up all of the power received by all of those 64 sensing devices as your device under test is being rotated 360 degrees in azimuth, usually around its monopole if it had one. And now you collect all that energy, and if you find out the total amount of power radiated to space was 0.5 watt, and the transmitter was putting out 0.55 watts, then you know by definition you've got 90% efficiency. You're measuring total radiated power. The way you and I would have to do that, let me drop. To measure total radiated power for that antenna in your backyard, and it has been done, but boy, is it expensive. You're going to take a helicopter, calibrated receiving equipment on the helicopter, and you go into each individual azimuth elevation. You're going to measure what happens directly north at 10 degrees to the right of north and 20 degrees to the right of north, and you're going to operate the helicopter at various altitudes. When you gather enough flight data, you're measuring the full that sphere of radiation around that antenna. You're going to measure all of that radiated power, and you're going to add it all up, so to speak. A very expensive, very time-consuming test, but that's the only accepted way of measuring total radiated power. You can measure the impedance until the cow comes home, until the cows come home, at the end of your transmission line that feeds the antenna. You're measuring the apparent impedance that your transmission line sees. That doesn't tell you of the energy you sent down that cable, what percentage of it was radiated into space, and what percentage of it got coupled into Earth, and is heating up the local Earth around you. That measurement at the antenna doesn't tell you that. It just tells you you've got a good impedance match. Total radiated power, as you can tell, is a very enthusiastic test. Not often done, not easy to do. It can be done at microwave frequencies with a Satomo machine, in real space and HF antennas. There are broadcast stations. Let me drop.
Dick, that lobe recognition is also done with the helicopter that reveals the lobe pattern also, correct?
If you've probably measured and recorded all of the energy at various altitudes, at various azimuths with the helicopter, that means you go out there, let's say a mile away, and you fly the helicopter all the way up to some very high altitude, and you do that up and down measurement in all of those azimuth angles, yes. You're now measuring the full 360 degrees, not it. There's 41,000 square degrees on the surface of a sphere, but you're looking at a hemisphere of what's going on above Earth. So you're looking at half of 41,000, let's call it 20,000 square degrees. In theory, you're measuring the energy in every one of those 21,000 square degrees on that upper hemisphere. And once you gather that data, you know the pattern of the antenna, and if you add it all together, you know the total radiated power that went into space as opposed to coupled into Earth. As you can tell, it's a very difficult measurement. So for you and I to sit in the shack and make a measurement at this end of the transmission line or at the far end of the transmission line and make an assumption as to how much of that RF energy is being radiated into space with what antenna pattern versus how much of it is coupled into the Earth, you can see it's an extremely difficult test. I'm not trying to scare you. I just want you to know where the minefield is, if you know what I mean. I know we've gotten a little bit left of center, Joe, but maybe this helps somewhat. The B2RIY, the guy who started us off on this one tonight, K2RIW, you got a joke.
I just started you off on talking about jokes that go around the outside of coax cable. So I know this went off on one of these tangents somewhere. I have another question, and I'd like you to put it after the mailbag, if you have some time to go back to it. And it has to do with a broadcast station, but the question I'm asking, actually in reality, I should say, is more of a real genuine RF question, something I've just observed of a local broadcast station. So back to you.
Okay, we'll come back to that. Believe it or not, although it looks like we went off to a tangent, as you put these ferrite beads or these toroids or whatever on the outside of your coax cable, you're creating a bounding action. You're creating a kind of an RF choke on the outside of the coax cable only. And the magic of the way coax cable works is that the RF energy flowing down the center of the cable doesn't know what you've done to the outside. It doesn't affect it. You put 100 watts into that cable, and it's low loss cable. Still 100 watts goes flowing through it, no matter what you've done to the outside. However, when the signal gets to the end of the transmission line, and it gets coupled to the thing that you think is an antenna, that you think is going to radiate all your valuable RF energy into space, and hopefully couple none of it into the local Earth, and heat up the Earth, now all of a sudden life gets complicated, and how much of it flows back down. So the balloning devices, the toroids that you're talking about, is the first good step to stop RF energy from flowing down the outside of the cable, which in most cases is undesirable. It's not a showstopper. The fact that you've got a hot piece of cable, RF energy flowing down the outside. Let me drop. RF energy flowing down the outside of the cable. It's not going to crash and burn. It's not going to, in most cases, create a huge problem. However, it means that the predictability of your antenna pattern is becoming more difficult, because now your cable is doing some of the radiating, as well as the thing that you call antenna. If that transmission line happens to run by the wife's television set while she's watching her favorite program, or you're in an apartment building and that transmission line runs alongside of somebody else's apartment and couples energy into their television set by way of the radiation of your cable, that can give you some grief. So making sure that no RF energy flows down the outside of the cable is a good thing to do. In a pinch, lots of guys have simply taken a dipole and connected it purely to the end of a coax cable. Right side of the dipole goes to the center conductor, left side goes to the shield. It works. It's less than desirable. And so at some later time, if you put the right kind of a bounding device there, whether it be a poor man's RF choke, multiple turns of the cable, or a real bounding device, you can always add that later and make improvements in the system. But figuring out how much of your RF energy at HF frequencies is really part of the total radiated power into space. As you can see, that measurement is far from easy. You can easily make simple tests where you've compared it to a dipole and you've made a measurement a mile away. Well, that dipole has a different phase center at a different altitude. So therefore, that changes the results. If you had the ability to have a crank-up tower, let me drop. If you set up, let me say, you could easily do this frequency, do this test on, say, 2 meters, where the antenna is 36 inches long, 38 inches long, a vertical dipole, and you've now mounted that vertical dipole some reasonable distance alongside of your tower, and the tower is a crank-up tower, and now you've got a guy a mile away measuring field strength as you change the altitude of that vertical dipole by cranking up, cranking down your crank-up tower. By changing that altitude, because of the way the signal, some of it, because multipath is always there, and there's always a direct path, there's always at least one path bouncing off the ground, and other paths bouncing off other things in the environment, like the local water tower. As you raise and lower your antenna, the phase angle of the signal getting to the water tower and the phase angle of the signal going directly to your remote receiving site a mile away, those two things are beating against each other. As that crank-up tower goes up and down, you're going to see a ripple pattern in signal strength versus altitude that you're measuring a mile away or 10 miles away. So altitude measures counts. You can see that just simply making a measurement, comparing two antennas, when the two antennas are not in the exact same location at the exact same altitude, you can easily make an error, even though you've made a measurement that looks good. Life isn't simple. Over to you for any final comments on this one, Joe, and we'll go back to your other question about broadcast antennas a little bit later. W2RYY for some final comments. K2RIW TechNet, good question.
I was trying to bring the brain teaser to the TechNet, you know? It just helps everybody get going there, the thinking process. Very good. Okay, I'll be listening for a while and go up to the next guy. Thanks, Vic.
Yeah, we kept Ken patiently waiting. Delta 2, India Charlie Victor, if I can read my own writing. Go right ahead, Ken. K2IW in the TechNet.